This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, open year-round. Learn more at bbg.org.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
I'm HRN's Communications Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're fresh off our trip to Slow Food Nations in Denver, a festival that brought together advocates to discuss the future of food. And this week, we're bringing you a special episode inspired by the new Equity, Inclusion, and Justice Manifesto released by Slow Food USA.
If we're going to solve food security, we need to say these people have a right to good, healthful food. But we have to do that in a way that kind of insulates this system from the vagaries of the market.
Because when you're at a table with somebody, you recognize their humanity. And when somebody cooks for you and serves you food, in a way they're saying they care about your survival.
How can we put things into our own hands and have the people of Puerto Rico gain real access to healthy local foods?
Listen to Meat and Three this week for our highlights from Slow Food Nations, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network, where each week I interview an extraordinary person who works behind the scenes in the restaurant business. We talk about successes and challenges in the industry and in life. Today, my guest is Elise Cornac, someone who has defined success differently from many other people in the restaurant world. After working at the Spotted Pig and at Aquavit in New York City, she opened a restaurant with her wife, Anna Hieronymus, called Take Root. It took root really quickly. Do people make that pun all the time? It's sort of appalling, right? Yeah, it's so bad.
But it's so easy to do.
I know. It must make you want to change the name.
It does. We wanted to change it upon it happening.
Yeah,
so.
Right. Okay. Skip the metaphor. But it was beloved, booked, won awards for the cooking, and received a Michelin star. And about a little over a year ago, Anna and Elise did the completely unexpected for the rest of the world, but I think completely expected for them, closed the restaurant at, you can call it its height, but who knows what the height would have been, right? That's one of those Buddhist things.
It's true.
Right? And moved upstate. So welcome, Elise.
Well, thank you for having me. I feel like I haven't gotten out of saying, like, welcome to people and thank you for coming. Like, even when I'm at somebody else's house, Anna and I still do it. So awkward, but thank you for having me.
Right. That always reminds me of my childhood. I was so well trained. I curtsied when I would shake hands. I would curtsy when I met someone. Yeah, and that
I love the formality.
I know. Like, that didn't stop special. Until I was, like, 13 years old.
It's very elegant.
It was embarrassing. Yeah. Yeah, I had an elegant youth. So we first met at Fab in Charleston just a few months ago, which for me, I feel like is so late in your life in food because you made such a gigantic grand mark with the restaurant. And so I was so happy to get to know you a little bit. And what struck me so deeply was your sense of originality, honesty, compassion, and I just want to talk about all of those things because the way in which you and Anna have chosen to live in this world, the restaurant world that I've spent so much time a part of, is, I would say, completely original.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I'm very grateful that we met a couple months ago. It's so funny because we had so many people that we both admired and loved in between us. So I felt like maybe from afar we were connected. So it didn't seem like I had met somebody I'd never met. But yeah, it's funny. I've been told since I was very little, like from my parents, why do you always have to do things different than everybody else? You're making it so difficult for yourself. But for me, I always felt like I was making it more fun, because I was kind of creating a path that maybe others would follow or maybe they wouldn't. I didn't really care either way.
But how did you, I am always curious how one gets that confidence, born to it, I imagine. But are there stories of when someone tried to stop you from doing that thing that you wanted to do and you just kept going?
I mean, literally all the time. I mean, every note from every teacher was always to my parents. You know, Elise was doing X, Y, or Z, and, you know, I tried to get her to stop doing X, Y, or Z, and she wouldn't. And that was something that always, you know, kind of, I kind of loved because it made me realize that, okay, I wasn't doing what everybody else was doing, and definitely gave my parents, like, every gray hair on their head. But I think as I got older, they started to kind of live vicariously through my difference. And my mom is also a little bit of a rebel herself in her spirit, and so I think I got a little bit of that from her as well.
It's great when your parents don't try to shut it down. My son, William, is here with us, and I don't know, William, have I tried to shut you down? He says not particularly.
Good.
I think that's great.
As it should be.
So I loved that what you said about the launch of Take Root was that it was an anthropological project in a certain way, a way of looking at restaurants and what you personally wanted to accomplish and seeing where those two things could meet. When you look back and you that's your textbook, like what did you learn from that? Is it possible to do a restaurant in a completely personal way, and is that our future?
You know, I think
let's start with what Take Root stood for and what it was, because our listeners might not know. So in the broadest sense, it was a restaurant that was run by two people, manned by two people, everything from sweeping the stoop, garbage, cooking, cleaning.
Crazy but true.
And it was 12 seats. As a tasting menu, it was $120 or $125, and 10, 12 courses. So, and it was your beautiful, completely coherent vision.
Yes.
So that's superficially, because those are just facts. Mm-hmm. But what emotionally was that restaurant to you?
You know, emotionally, I feel like for us, Anna and I, in our lives, in dining and in our relationship, we have this constant motto that is the creating the balance of comfort and intrigue. And we have mentioned it in many interviews and to many friends and to many family members that we kind of feel like that's best defines what we look for in a good experience. And it doesn't always have to involve food, but when it does and it's done well, you can really tell what I mean by that. You know, there might be a course or a moment when you're dining at Take Root or when you were dining at Take Root that you felt like you were having this big hug. You know, I remember the brioche course would come out and the room would be dead quiet. And there were huge slices that looked like the little brioche emoji that you click on. And the room smelled like the Wonder Bread factory, but better. And there was not a sound to be had. And there was crunching and there was smearing of butter. And then it stopped. And the next course would come out and it'd be very challenging. Either it would be a technique that people hadn't seen before. Or maybe it was an ingredient or the way it was plated. And then people would kind of sit up straight again. And then you'd hear murmuring and whispering. And we loved that push and pull, you know, the opposite sides of the spectrum, because always we would remind our guests that you were going to come swinging back through the middle every once in a while. And I think that our approach to opening Take Root and running it was very much that as well. You know, we wanted to have a quality of life, so that would be the comfort side, which how we did that, not having staff, not having to pay other people, creating our own schedule. And then the intrigue part was always kind of keeping ourselves on the feet by doing something a little different. That was painful sometimes, but often very thrilling at the same time.
I noticed the use of the word over and over of intrigue.
Yeah.
And it feels like it wasn't workshopped. It just like came to you because it's sort of in your spirit.
It's true.
And also I feel like some marketing person somewhere would say, that's not a good word.
It's true. And somebody did say that to us.
I think it's a really great word, but I want to go down that road because you've explained it clearly in terms of the menu in the restaurant, but I want to know what it means to you, like in your everyday life. Like, you know, what intrigues you right now? Like, is it a book? Is it film? Is it people? And like, what specifically?
I think for me, the word intrigue kind of means that you want to dig deeper. You know, there's something that has piqued your interest and then you do want to know more. You're not just saying that's interesting and walking away from it. Right now, as we're working on our next project, I'm very passionate about historical narrative and how that plays into food. what are the stories that are people were telling that don't involve food, and how did they affect how food was being eaten then? The obvious is...
And what's an example of that?
So, for example, in creating some dishes for our upcoming project, you know, there are some that are inspired by actual agricultural techniques in the Catskills, and some that are just stories of how, like, somebody had this crazy run-in with their neighbor over their land, parcel of land in 1830, and the way they interacted in the conversation they had reminded me of the juxtaposition of two ingredients. So that's not something a diner is going to pick up on immediately. Of course not. And certainly we're not going to have anyone stand and tell them that story either, because that would bore them. But hopefully that the spirit of the dish kind of tells that story in its own capacity. So I've been very drawn by narrative that is not food narrative. And how does that affect how we eat and think and cook?
And is it important to you to know that in your mind as you're creating? Like, is that sort of the bedrock for you, because your food is complex and intriguing? Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, but do you need that narrative in your mind in order to create that?
You know, I do, because I always wanted to be the kind of chef that said, oh, you know, a tomato is perfect when it just says olive oil and salt, and let the ingredients speak for themselves. It just, I think maybe my mind is working, you know, too much, and it's on overdrive constantly, and it's thinking a little too much about everything. But in the sense, I kind of feel grateful that I'm looking always for the story and the meaning and kind of why people love something or why they don't, and then wanting to kind of push that into my dishes. And it's important for me because I feel like there's depth to everything I'm doing, and that kind of keeps me going.
Well, let's talk about the relationship of that and art, because when you were in college, you studied art. Mm-hmm. I know you studied drawing, and then you worked in art galleries, mm-hmm, afterwards. And to me, what you just described is really the artist's work, right? Mm-hmm. If I go and look at a Diebenkorn, or if I go and look at an abstract painter, mm-hmm, I might see none of the story. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I might read about the story, but it's my emotional reaction. I mean, mm-hmm, what do you feel like the relationship between your loving and studying art and the cooking that you're doing and the thinking that you're doing? What is that?
I think because my senior thesis was essentially, it was very thin graphite drawings with wire. And so what I created was I would draw something, you know, they were all figure drawings, and I would see what was there and I'd want to remove some of the pieces. Maybe it was a line that created the elbow or the shoulder, and I'd want to replace it with something that was not on the page. So for me, it was all about that missing piece. And so when you're looking at food and you put something that together that everyone assumes goes together, but if you take out one of those pieces and someone's saying, well, oh, the basil's missing from this tomato salad, well, why is it missing and what is it being replaced with? Then you're creating a conversation. So by putting the wire on the paper, I created a shadow when the light hit it. So the shadow landed where the graphite would, but when the light was not there, there was no line. And so the idea of pulling things...
That's amazing.
I actually, it's something I'm very, very proud of. And it's so funny because it was completely different than what I was doing before that thesis. So
what had you been doing before?
Very broad strokes oil painting. And when I switched what I wanted to do to my advisor, she was like basically dropped dead. I was like 6 weeks before the senior thesis show, and she's like, what? You're basically done. I was like, I hate everything and I want to trash it all. So
do you feel that way about your dishes sometimes?
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be a tragic artist if I didn't want to throw things away half the time.
Are you tragic?
I think a little. I mean, my brothers have been telling me I'm so emo since I was so little. I mean, I would write these like really emotional songs for my parents as gifts. So that pretty much sums it up.
You don't strike me as tragic.
Anymore.
But what was the emo part? Like, was there a great sadness that you were drawing upon?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was in the closet until after college, so I'm certain there was an influence there. And then on top of it, I think that there's always something when you're creating something that you want people to understand it, but at the same time, when they understand it too much, you almost feel like they're getting too close to you, so you want to push it away. And I remember Anna always going mad because I would create a new dish, I'd finally put it on the menu, everyone would love it, and then I would take it off. And she was like, well, why are you doing that? It makes literally no sense. I'd say, well, everyone's understanding it too much. It needs to be removed. And it doesn't make any sense to me. I said, well, it does to me. So,
and I'm in control.
Yeah, and I'm in control. But then, you know, often with some conversation between she and I would soften around it and understand why people were loving it was not because they understood it, because they didn't. And then I would say, okay, I'm willing to maybe leave it on for a few more weeks.
So your goal is to not be understood.
I think
that's to be known.
I think again, it's that balance. You know, it's that comfort and intrigue. I want people to feel comfortable around me. I find myself rather approachable. I've been told that my whole life. But at the same time, I give people, you know, maybe 85% of who I am, and that other 15 is reserved maybe just for me or just for people who like really want that kind of darker side, I guess.
It reminds me of something that I read that Anna had said about how you completely, totally, and 100% understand each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even have to talk the 15% for
her. It's true. It's true. It's true. I mean, we really did spend every waking moment together, which I think in hindsight, there was definitely some not negatives, but difficulties with that. But at the same time, it was like this concentrated, you know, 5 years that we basically feel like we knew each other 15 by the time we were done, because it was just the two of us and because we were together every single day, all day, we had to learn this like kind of kooky little language between the two of us to kind of make shortcuts, but also to share love and emotion throughout service that we needed to keep ourselves, you know, uplifted.
And so what did that entail? What is the secret quirky little language?
So one thing that's kind of funny is in the dining room at Take Root, there was only one, between the kitchen and the dining room, there was only one very skinny wall that we could stand behind where people couldn't see us. And it was like the size of one of our bodies. We had to stand facing each other behind it if we wanted to have any conversation that people couldn't see or hear. And so that wall became kind of hilarious by the end because we shared very warm moments and, you know, and touching moments behind it, but we also fought in whispers behind it very often too. But the language, you know, a lot of them were through our eyes. They were just, you know, we had to understand, you know, not only just behind you when you're carrying a plate, but also like, you know, this person is like this, this person is like that. Be prepped before you approach the table. And we now can still do it. I will regrettably say that Anna sometimes sends me those looks across the dining table if I'm saying something I shouldn't. And I'm like, no, I don't remember that sign. I'm just going to keep talking.
Right, it's sort of the eye equivalent of the swift kick in the
ankle.
Like,
exactly.
Don't go there.
Exactly. And I'm very familiar with it because I have a 100% Italian mom. She used to call it the evil eye. Uh-huh. She'd send it through the rear view mirror. So.
keep you tamped down in the back of the car.
Exactly.
So when you were, just going back to this notion of narrative and the idea that you were doing, you know, a 12-course tasting menu, was that a narrative? In addition to the, I understand, the comfort and the intrigue, was there a story you were trying to tell? Like, what was the, because you could have done anything, right? I mean, you could have done family style. I mean, you could have done
absolutely
all Italian.
Yeah.
And your background being, your restaurant background being Spotted Pig and Aquavit. I was interested when I, you know, learned that your next step, the thing that you had like so deep inside of you, was actually a 12-course tasting menu, because you wouldn't necessarily have predicted that. Mm-hmm. So is it because there was a story you wanted to tell throughout that time, or like how did that?
Well, I think that, you know, tasting menus are so polarizing. I'm sure you understand that. I mean, fine dining in its quality and its sense is kind of, you know, it's exclusive by price, you know, it's lengthy and how long you have to sit at a table. But for me, I love the study of somebody's mind through food. So you're sitting there and they're sharing with you little moments of their mind. You don't get to stay with those moments very long because they last, what, 3 bites, maybe 4? And so that's what I was really drawn to and have still been very drawn to, and what we intend to do with our next place as well. And I think so often people who aren't familiar with creating tasting menus or dining at them, they think it's just a series of dishes, you know, I'll start with something small, something medium, and then it'll get bigger, and then it's something sweet. And that's important as well, of course. But I think that...
But is it important? I mean, I ask that because, you know, it strikes me that we have this convention around... the way that we eat. And the convention is you start small and then maybe you get to middle and then you get bigger. And that's in terms of size. It's also in terms of flavor. It's also ironically, the interest is usually the inverse, right? The most interesting thing is the small thing. The least interesting thing is the big thing. But I don't know. Does that have to be the convention? Like, seems like that's ripe for deception.
No, absolutely. And I think that when we did start to challenge those things, we always would hear people say to us about 3/4 of the meal, because the first 3/4, there was no protein. There was, you know, usually no fish or meat at all. Maybe, a sauce or, you know, a mousse of a liver of some fish or something that would appear with a vegetable. But for the most part, it wasn't there. And then by the time they did taste something, it was very small. And they said, well, I didn't even realize I wasn't eating meat, or, you know, that's in terms of the ingredients, or like the bread, instead of it coming first, it came in the middle towards the end of the meal. And, you know, just the other day, Anna and I were out you know, doing something upstate, and we stopped to get ice cream, and it was like 5:30, and then we got home and made dinner, and we were both thinking, like, that was so fun, you know, that we had dessert first. But at the same time, it actually changed what we wanted to eat for dinner, because we had already been satiated in that sweet way. So we ended up having super salty pasta for dinner because it was like, that's what we craved. So I think there is something fun about turning these conventions on their head. And also for your palate, I mean, it's exciting. It's, you know, not something you're expecting to come next is better than something you're expecting to come next.
Actually, I love that idea. Like, truly, why does sweet have to come last? I mean, maybe there's a reason, mm-hmm. but maybe there isn't a reason.
And, absolutely.
I end every meal with like one piece of chocolate. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just
always have it in the freezer at our house for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just something, I don't know why. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if it's biological craving that's how I want to finish a meal. So maybe there is something that sweet comes after, but I don't know. I feel like it's just generations of people. Mm-hmm. Put ice cream at the end.
Yeah, I recall reading something that David Kinch had said about his tasting menu at Manresa, where they started the meal and ended it with something that looked identical. They had totally different flavors, but one was savory and one was sweet. And the idea of a bookending a meal, I thought, was really fascinating. Even though it was starting with savory and ending with sweet, it was this kind of mind flip on you that, wait, I had that already. But then when you put it in your mouth, you didn't. And I think that there's always ways to twist and turn those conventions of sweet and savory. Though I will say, I think a lot of people want to end their meal with something sweet. And like, they really look around like, well, is this over by the last savory course? And I used to have to tell them, we had our pre-dessert, I'd say, this is your last course before the sweet stuff comes, because they always wanted to know, because they'd want to get something different to drink. So I think it's comfort. Again, it's tradition. People really like that.
So are there chefs like David Kinch, or your menu sounds a little bit Dan Barber's? Dan Barber has like the extraordinary bread course like in the middle of the meal at Stone Barns, Blue Hill Stone Barns. Are there chefs that you look up to who you think are turning things upside down, inside out, that you admire? Or
yeah, I think that actually what's funny...
Or who are doing just things that the old-fashioned way, which is another thing to admire.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. It's funny, April and I, since many years ago having worked there, have become friends as, you know, I've moved through the industry. And I can dine at her restaurant.
April Bloomfield, who was the chef at Spotted Pig, and now, yeah.
And to me, I always used to think, I remember making this dish that I actually make for myself literally all the time at home now. It was her radish salad, and it was radish with Parmesan and basil. And the method of how it was made was more complicated than how it tasted. And I remember thinking to myself when I would create tasting menus, like, why are we approaching fine dining or tasting menus any different than we are just a dish that somebody's getting there? Like the salty and the crunchy and the savory and the sweet and all the balance. And I think that I'm usually inspired by and drawn to people who are creating very simple food. And it doesn't have to matter what the setting of the restaurant is. You know, I had the most amazing meal of my entire life at Restaurant at Meadowood. Okay, that's incredible. 3 Michelin star restaurant. But
Meadowood, which is in Napa Valley, and Chris Costas, the chef, and it is a parade of extraordinary dishes on extraordinary plates in an extraordinary place.
It absolutely is. Right. And we were lucky enough to stay there too, so I was very happy about that. but I've also had, you know, extraordinary meals at places, you know, upstate that are just on the roadside. And it's about the spirit of the place, but also the intention of the chef behind it. And you don't always need to know why you're doing something simply, but when you have that intuitive thought to do it that way, I feel like I'm drawn to cooks like that mostly.
I think April's such an interesting example, though, because having cooked her recipes or you know, knowing her cookbooks, what is on the plate seems so simple. Mm-hmm. Justin Smiley is a little bit this way too, from Upland. Mm-hmm. People in this robust Italian tradition, but then you find the technique behind it, and you see how long it takes to either put together the dish or, you know, all the steps that are involved. And what you have at the end of the day is like a perfect piece of meat in a stew. Mm-hmm. But you're like, oh, you didn't do that, like, you know, over an open flame, just sitting there breaking down the...
It's totally true. I was saying to you before we started this that I just started listening to books on tape, and the one I just finished was Provence 1970. I just figured, why not start there? And so then, of course, I went off on a million tangents and started researching everybody that was ever mentioned in the book. And Richard Olney
really
came to... Yeah, it really was. But Richard Olney has come, you know, up a few times in my career, and I was retouching back on his writing and his approach to food and that complex simplicity, which I think is so fun. Because when you look at a dish... Like one we had at Take Root was our vegetable tea course, and it was
that blows my mind.
Yeah, it was really special, and it was inspired by my wife and my. We have a ritual every morning where we have coffee together, and I love all the different things that hold the cream and the sugar and the spoons and everything that happens. And but holding something warm, and the vegetable tea took a week to make, and all it looked like was clear brown liquid. So it was like, so when it would come to the table, I mean, it'd be this incredible smell, but really, like what you're looking at is clear brown liquid. So
tell how you make it, because that is really interesting.
Yeah, so essentially we quarter the onions and then we dry them like tea leaves in the oven, and so they end up looking brown and shriveled, not terribly exciting. And then we steep them in hot water without a single bubble coming to the surface, so that they really do steep. And usually it stays pretty clear then, but I like it perfectly clear. So then we do the clarification via the freezer method for like a consommé instead of clarifying it with a raft. And then it just is incredible. And it's like, it tastes like a concentrated French onion soup, but feels like water in your mouth.
I want to try that one day.
You will. You absolutely will. It's going to stay with me forever.
But I guess, are there things that you feel like you'll take with you forever? That's one.
That is definitely one. Yeah. And yeah, there's a couple like dishes that I always say to Anna, I really want to bring that one back, but I don't want to do something again. Cause you know, I think a lot of chefs have trouble like repeating things. Some don't, but, so I think there definitely will be some other ingredients or techniques or dishes that will come back in their own new way.
Okay. So, let's talk about your new project if it's talkable. So there will be a next, and,
absolutely.
After this question, we're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk about one of the things that fascinates me the most, which is your ability to control your mind and time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think most people fret that they will never have success again, mm-hmm. that how can they stop doing something that's working, and they really don't think about how to have a great life. And I feel like you and Anna have spent a lot of time thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
But before we take that break, I just want to hear, what are you thinking about a next project? I don't know if it has a name. Does it have a place? Does it have a size?
Can't reveal the name yet, but...
But it has one. That's good.
It does have a name.
And it's not going to be Take Root.
It's not going to be Take Root. So it's going to be in the Catskills on the west side of the river, which is where my wife and I live. And it'll be deeply in the mountains. We are in the process, literally as we speak right now, of buying a property. It's a little bit drawn out because there's some hurdles to get over, but it's the dream spot that we've been looking for a year. And it will be a tasting menu. And it's... The property, if it goes through, fingers crossed, has stunning mountain views and river frontage, and it's really everything that we've kind of ever dreamed of making come true. But we really want to bring the spirit of what the Catskills have been to people from the city and from there back to, you know, the hearts of visitors and locals, which is, you know, it's a vacation place, it's a retreat, but also kind of the spirit of the history and the narrative and the ingredients, and through our lens, which is, you know, both feminine and fun, but also comforting and intriguing.
And will you have places to stay? A place to stay?
For guests. We will not on the property, but there are some really awesome places literally down the street or a few miles away that some friends of ours own, and some bigger places for people to stay. And that was also part of the why it took so long to find a place.
Because it just seems like you need those two.
Of course.
Ideally they come together,
of
right?
Course,
so that you have tourists and locals, and you'll be a destination to be sure. And you want people to be able to go to sleep after they,
And that was, you know, and the kind of positive of where we live is it's so beautiful everywhere. So a lot of the properties we looked at were really beautiful, but they maybe didn't have all the things that were necessary. And a few of them we placed offers on and fell through for a bunch of different reasons. But and then when we saw this one, we're like, oh, wow, everything really happened for a reason. But now we have to get it. So we have a few yucky things to do first, which is, you know, including town boards and zoning and stuff. But once that gets done, which it will, the power of positive thought, we will have the place and then eventually be able to kind of talk a little bit more openly about the name and the concept and what we're going to be doing there.
I think you came pretty close, though.
Yeah.
I think that's great, because I feel like I'd heard you thinking about different places and different ideas behind what you would do. So it's really good to know this.
Yeah.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, you know, living your best life and controlling it and not being controlled by success.
Totally.
Totally.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays year-round. On Thursday, August 23rd, Brooklyn Botanic Garden will host the Beer and Bocce Benefit, a one-of-a-kind garden party featuring lawn games, live music, and unlimited beer tastings by some of Brooklyn's top beer makers. Proceeds from the Beer and Bocce Benefit provide essential support for the garden's educational and community programs. And mark your calendars for the annual Chili Pepper Festival on Saturday, September 29th. New York's hottest fall tradition will set the garden ablaze with scorching bands from around the world, dozens of fiery food artisans, and hours of chili chocolate debauchery. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
And welcome back. This is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly. My guest today is Elise Cornack. You maybe know her from her restaurant, Take Root, with her wife, Anna Hieronymus. I love that name.
I know. I mean, and you nailed it, too, because no one does.
So. But Hieronymus Bosch.
Yes.
The artist.
True.
And I bet there must have been jokes in her childhood around.
Oh, every time we say her name to anybody, they say that.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. I've hit probably the two largest cliches in your world.
It's true. But actually, you nailed her name, which usually gets like Anna Anonymous, and no one gets it right. So you did.
It's better than like Anna Anonymous.
Yes, it's true. That's true.
God. So when one of the things it seemed you wanted to do in starting your own restaurant is control your time, mm-hmm. and you were open 3 days a week. You took a break in there. You closed the restaurant for a few months. You needed to renovate. Mm-hmm. That alone is unusual mm-hmm. because lost revenue mm-hmm. And a lot of other reasons. Mm-hmm. And then you just plain old shut mm-hmm. down without a plan.
It's true.
Yeah. That to me would be, panic attack territory. So tell me how you think about what's valuable in life mm-hmm. and how you've achieved that.
So I feel like I'm both fortunate, and I wouldn't say unfortunate, but I'm fortunate that my parents have always instilled in us to do something that makes us happy. And they've made that possible by being, successful in their own rights. And I also am familiar with, mental unwellness. My mother struggles from depression and anxiety. And so I'm very aware of, how important our mental and physical health is. Also, my dad is a doctor and my mom's a yoga teacher. So, so it's definitely there. And my wife's family owns a holistic health center. So it's not present in our life. But
did that help a lot, actually? Because that seems like that's a lot of support from people saying, follow your path mm-hmm. and block out the outside.
Absolutely. I mean, 100%. Now it's reversed. Now I'm telling my mom that, like, come on, follow your path, do your truth. When she's making decisions and she's hemming and hung, I'm like, well, what did you tell me? But, so definitely that's, at the core, the most important. Any support system is how you can make any really major decision in your life. But also, I think from an art background, when you put your pen to paper, your brush to paper for the first time, you're not thinking, oh, I'm going to make a masterpiece. This is going to live forever. It's going to be in a museum. Everyone's going to love it. You're just working. You're just, working something
Although,
out.
I don't know. I think there's probably lots of people who are like, I'm going to make a masterpiece. I'm a genius.
They hope that. but, more often than not, you're actually just doing studies or you're mm-hmm. practicing and you're working. And truth be told, the beginning of Take Root was just that. I mean, we were doing a supper club in our backyard. We got kicked out because it wasn't legal. We looked for a spot that was. So it was a solution to a problem. And then the name was taken over from the supper club. We both hated it, but unfortunately it went into paper at one point. And we were like, okay, it's over now. And we ended up actually kind of laughing, looking back on the fact that it was symbolic in the way that it was like we actually clearly did need to stay there and make some roots for a few more years than we anticipated. And so I think my approach to any project I do is always, it doesn't have to last forever. Mm-hmm. If it does, wonderful. If it doesn't, that's equally wonderful. And I think that approach in itself is what keeps us both, Anna and myself, sane, because then you're not so attached to the outcome of what you're doing and you're more in falling in love with the process.
And what about balancing your open-ended approach mm-hmm. with Anna's perhaps less open-ended approach?
It's funny. There's a lot of "it's gonna be okay" from me.
And like, how does she take that? Like, is that annoying to her at some point, or she just?
She's learned over the years to really trust me. It took a while. I remember a number of occasions while owning the restaurant that I would assure her that things were going to be okay. And there was a couple times that maybe I was like, okay, it better be because I'm really putting all my eggs in this basket. But, and it always was. So I think by now she's learned that if I'm saying that, I really do mean it, and that she can just like relax. So I'm very grateful that she trusts me in that way, but sometimes it's a little bit of a burden.
Well, of course, because then you have to make it happen.
It's
like,
true.
She puts so much trust in you, and you're like,
it's true.
Want to make it it's real.
True. It's true. But then the role sometimes becomes she supports me in being kind of the leader. So it's very interesting that, you know, I assure her things are going to be okay, but then she kind of like, you know, holds my hand through it. So it's very interesting how it kind of balances itself out.
Huh. Is that why you're like, the perfect yin yang?
I mean, I'm very lucky to have her in my life and to marry such a wonderful person, but also like I need her because she really does balance me out for sure.
I think the love story is you met like in Cubbyhole Bar, mm-hmm. and you met one night and you literally were never
apart.
Yeah,
that was literally it. Yeah.
Yeah. How did you know?
So it's funny because I will share it honestly. I had been on the way to the bar and I'd lost something that was important to me on the way that was also important to Anna. And she said to me, like, let's go out on the street and look for it and blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay. And we started talking. And before you know it, I said, you want to come back to my apartment? And she was saying, yeah, I have some of that stuff that you were losing. and I said, great. So we came back and hung out and we ended up staying up till 6 a.m. talking about ghosts and paranormal, and which we both, you know, believe in and have a lot of opinions on. And we were both like, this is weird and fun. And then she spent the night and that was basically it. And so it was a moment of realizing, like, if you can have like really odd and interesting and fun conversations with this person and laugh with them and enjoy their company this quickly, I should look into this a little further for sure.
Okay, well, let's look into ghosts and paranormal.
Yeah.
So because you're probably living in an area where there's ghosts and
100%.
And have you come across some? And do you think it's unusual to find someone who shares your belief in those two things?
Well, now in knowing my wife's family, definitely not. But in mine, certainly.
Why? Because they also believe in...
They do. Mine do not
right.
As much. Some, a little. But my family's house in Nantucket abutted a cemetery my whole childhood. So I used to walk the cemetery to like kind of clear my head, which totally weirded my entire family out. And I would come back saying, you guys, I found headstones with your names on them. And they were like, that's so weird. Like, what are you talking about? And so to say that, those kinds of things to my wife and her, be like, oh, that's so cool. I was like, wow, let's do this. Anytime we were viewing houses before we got ours, we would go into the older houses, which there are a lot of upstate, you know, the old,
sure.
you know, farmhouses. And we'd be, our real estate agent would say, like, and look at this, and you guys can renovate that. And Anna would say, it's haunted. We need to leave. So it's kind of become a running joke that like anything that's not new might be haunted. But it's obviously not true.
But
could
of
be.
Course, then.
Could be. So,
exactly.
Could be. Yeah.
And sometimes it is.
Yeah, exactly.
But you were mentioning Nantucket, and I know you spent a lot of childhood time mm-hmm. there. And Nantucket is a seasonal place, mm-hmm. and it seemed like that notion of seasonality really landed with you and
most
helped
certainly.
Influence the idea that, you know, if you work 8 months a year mm-hmm. and you're closed 4 months, that's actually a way mm-hmm. of life. Mm-hmm. So, how did that thinking sort of seep into your mm-hmm. mind?
Well, at a very young age, I mean, my parents have had the house, I think we're nearing on 40 years now, or something like that, before me. So, I always fell in love with the idea of this place that was filled with life during a certain period of the year, and then it was quiet during the other. And after college, I lived there year-round, and I just loved the December-January period where it was, like, dark and quiet and sultry in terms of the spirit. But also, you know, there are sacrifices to be made when you take time off or you close, and we all are aware of that. You can't have it all the time. But I was lucky enough to work for a chef when I was young there in Nantucket who had three sons, and his wife was the hostess at the restaurant, and they would close in the winter and he'd coach his son's hockey team and they would, you know, be able to drive their kids to and from school. And I would ask him, how does it work? And he's like, it works because this is what we want in our life. It's important to us to be able to have those things. And it's also equally important to run a restaurant. So they made sacrifices that were necessary so they could do the things they felt they needed.
And what do you feel like the sacrifices are that you've made? I mean, shutting down for a year, mm-hmm. and then even the short term, you know, the break that you took mm-hmm. to renovate, what are mm-hmm. the sacrifices along the way that are meaningful to you, rather than like, oh, we haven't gotten, I mean, you've gotten tons of press, frankly. Like, you apparently can just, you know, walk down the street and send out and do recipes because you've done some recipe developing, I've seen, and then writing, you've done written some great pieces. So you can do that and still get tons of press. But what are the like true sacrifices?
Well, of course, the income sacrifice. We are very, very, very blessed in that we, you know, we saved, and then we also had some help from our families when we left in order to, you know, buy our house and to set our life up upstate. But we are also very lucky that upstate is not terribly expensive to live. You know, aside from a farmer's market trip every week, you know, we grow a good portion of our food, and, you know, the leisures are free, you know, hiking and swimming and fishing and stuff, and hanging with friends. So we're lucky in that sense. And then, you know, I also had connections that I had made through the industry that kept the ball rolling for me. I was able to do some speaking engagements and writing, and like you said, and also I consulted on some restaurants and, of course, got paid for that. So that's where the income got picked up.
Sacrifices.
The sacrifices, I would say.
Income. I mean, that's
a small one. The bigger one for me is really not having a source for my creativity, an outlet. You know, sharing food and cooking for people is really important to me, but not, you know, not in a home setting as much. In fact, I struggled really deeply with that when we moved upstate because I hadn't cooked for friends and family very often, and I kind of hated it for like the first 8 months. I felt like I was had so much anxiety over what I was cooking or how it was coming out, how people were receiving it, because that was just what embedded in my brain of how to cook.
And you couldn't turn that off.
I really couldn't. And for a while, Anna was like threatening me, we're not going to have people over anymore if you can't get this together. And eventually it softened and I started to realize like, this is just not a restaurant, so I don't need to treat it that way. And now, you know.
And what's the difference? Because it does seem like you're feeding people either way. Mm-hmm. What's the difference to you?
I think the difference is that when you're cooking in a restaurant setting, it's not just the food you're serving, it's the environment, the experience everyone's taking in, and they are, I mean, no matter how people want to look at it, everyone is critical of their experience in some capacity. Why? Because they're, you know, there's a transaction, you know, there's money being given. And so even if you go to your favorite neighborhood spot and you're like, oh, it doesn't matter what things cost or how they come out, I just love being here. Well, no, it really does, because you are at the end of the day paying a check. And so there's that pressure of wanting to people to be really happy and satiated and with your experience. Where at your house, like, there is no money being exchanged. It's just friendship and fun and laughter and conversation. So once I started to realize that those things were really, like, filling me up, I didn't need to worry about how people were taking the food.
That's funny, because I have clearly never worked in a restaurant. And I wrote a book called Master My Mistakes in the Kitchen, because I'm not a great cook. But I feel a huge amount of pressure just from having been the editor of Food and Wine for two decades.
Yeah, I mean.
And that everybody's like, you know, they really expect to come over and be well fed or thoughtfully fed. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I overfeed. I make 10 dishes. I can't make three. Like, I go to people's houses and they do like a roast chicken, a salad, like maybe a starch.
It's true.
And then dessert. I'm like, but really? That's all you have to do? I am characterologically incapable.
Oh, I totally get it. I mean, two nights ago we had our friend Kalu Henry over for dinner, and her husband, and we weren't planning on having them over for dinner. We were planning on going out, but the plans changed last minute, and I said, oh God, all I have in the house is nothing. So I was like, I have herbs from the garden. I'll make a pesto. Can you bring dried pasta? And she brought peaches and tomatoes, and we kind of like threw together this gorgeous salad and pasta, but like the dishes were in the sink and the pots were everywhere, and that is so not okay by me usually. But it started to rain outside, and we had the screen open, and we thought, like, this is great, actually. We don't even need to worry about the fact that, like, there's salty water all over the counter, and because the spirit of it was more important than the food.
Yeah, someday I'll get there.
Yeah, it took me a year. So
I don't think I have enough practice at it. I'm kind of not even close to that.
I definitely was, like, wiggling in my seat a little bit about it. But.
You still are today, just for those of you who can't see her wiggling. You've moved to a place that is, I mean, I guess it's not remote, but it's not, and it's 25 minutes from Hudson, New York. Mm-hmm. What does it feel like to be outside the trends, everything that everybody else is doing, the things you would read about on Instagram? Like, does that, how does that feel?
It feels a little bit relieving, but at the same time, I still feel through friendships and networking with people in the industry that we still are connected in a way. I mean, if we see friends that come up from the city or some that have moved up there, there's still the gossip and there's still the conversation about the restaurants and where to eat when you do go into the city and what to avoid and, you know, how the reviews were. I mean, of course, we're still staying up to date on everything that's going on just for fun.
But are you really?
Yeah.
Naturally.
Naturally. I mean, when a review comes out and I'm like hanging outside, I'll like pick it up and read it. But, you know, it's not the forefront anymore, which is where the relief comes from. It's, you know, I'm not worried about it. I don't think about it as much. But if I have some time, I'll, you know, scan through Eater and Grub Street.
And in thinking about what your next project will be, does the feeling of eyes on you, is that something that you welcome because it's nice to have the attention? Mm-hmm. Or I've read about how, you know, you expect a certain type of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. That's what mm-hmm. one does, right? As you mm-hmm. said, it's a transaction. But in thinking about the next project and the location in mm-hmm. which you're doing it, is that something that concerns you or not really at all? Or
it definitely does. Kind of a little bit more aware of it than I am, because I'm really focused on wanting to just like, you know, get the keys in hand, get right now. But I think currently in the community upstate, in both the Catskills and the Hudson Valley, there has not been, aside from maybe Zach Palaccio, any chefs that have moved from the city with any really significant reputation to do anything. Some really wonderful restaurants and some great people cooking, but all of them, their first thing was up there. And so I definitely am, and now it's growing so much in popularity and people are very attuned to what's going on upstate and everyone we know from the city is now, oh, I'm coming up, can I see you? And so I definitely think that things are
so busy. Yeah. You're like, I came here to get away.
I know. So I definitely think that in time, by the time we open, it'll be even more so. And I'm aware of the fact that some people didn't get a chance to come to Take Root. So there's probably some significant people out there that would love to taste our food or see what we're up to.
Will there be more than 12 seats?
Definitely, yes.
That's awesome. I was reading the piece that you did for Food and Wine, which I thought was extraordinary, which talked about sort of a decency pact, mm-hmm. common decency mm-hmm. pact, because there's so much conversation in the food world, important conversation about harassment, about mental health in the restaurant world. I think that not a lot of focus is put on the customer, mm-hmm. Because the customer somehow is just the protected mm-hmm. one. In restaurants, in theory, you can protect yourself in the back of the house because mm-hmm. it's whoever you hire.
Exactly.
But the customer is a little bit harder to control.
Of course.
Do you want to talk about your thoughts about like the role of the customer in creating a good restaurant environment?
Mm, of course. I think for so long, because of what I had mentioned earlier in regards to the financial transaction, we of course feel like, you know, we have no control over how to, you know, educate our customers or, you know, encourage them to behave a certain way, because, you know, you're taught for a very long time, first of all, they're always right. And secondly, that, you know, they're paying, so you can't say anything to them. But I actually think that the customer would benefit very greatly from having some guidelines, some boundaries, because I think that I dine with people often that, you know, don't really know what's appropriate anymore, especially with everything shifting with tipping and no tipping and how the back of house now delivers dishes. And so there's a lot of people, you know, specifically my family who is not in tune with the industry as much as I am. And they say, is this appropriate? Should I tip here? It says no gratuity, but I really want to. I liked my waitress. And so I actually think that right now we're in this moment where some guidelines would be really helpful and actually really beneficial to the relationship between the staff and the customer, and certainly like to benefit kind of a more a less scary conversation between the diner and the waitress or waiter that could be had, maybe a language that could be developed or, you know, something that would help everybody work through the issues that are, you know, still very present.
And like, where do you see that? Like, where do you envision that?
For us, we've talked a lot about in the next place, how are we going to, you know, put that at the forefront and what kind of things are we going to implement? And we've kind of discussed this thing actually that Anna coined, the common decency agreement of is there a way that it could be on our website? Should it be when they make their reservation? Would it be on the menu? Like, what way is it not going to be intrusive and affect the experience? Because of course, these are really important questions to ask. You know, you don't want to sit down for dinner and then have this like, you know, contract in front of you that you have to sign. I mean, how awkward, right? But we want to find a way to create that language between customers and diners. And one of that is to train the staff to feel comfortable to say when things are inappropriate in a way that's not going to, you know, make the diner feel ostracized. And I think a lot of that is also creating responsibility on the waiter, waitress, host, bartenders, and to speak for themselves and not necessarily turn to the managing partners and learn that, you know, they them too are a human being and how they're being treated matters, and they don't need a, you know, approval from somebody above them to speak out. And what language can we give them that's not going to make the diner feel uncomfortable?
Right. I think you also don't seem afraid of firing your diners, which is important, yeah. Right? Because there are a lot of people who want their restaurants to be a place for absolutely everyone. Mm-hmm. And you have very strong beliefs and you want your diners to know that you have them. It doesn't matter if they share them. They just can't like actively object to them.
Of course. I mean, right now in this moment in our country, I mean, no restaurant or retail shop is just selling what they're selling. They're selling a point of view, and that is much deeper than just through their craft. It's, you know, it's social, it's political, it's environmental. You know, we would be silly to not think that people are thinking those things when they come to our restaurant. And alternatively, that people aren't coming there because we think those things. And so I think, you know, we all reserve the right to, you know, turn down business from anybody at any time. And we also understand that we're then sacrificing that person's check and maybe a bad Yelp review or them telling their friends. But I think you have to always balance what are you gaining from having that person really there, that $35 or maybe it's $1,000 if it's an expensive tasting menu, but their energy is then sitting in that seat and sitting with your staff, and that memory of them being there really tugs on you for a long time. I know it's still, some of them still do with me. So,
well, speaking of, Yelp reviews, that, you know, the one of the poignant things in that Food and Wine piece was a woman who hadn't dined in the restaurant but gave you a review on Yelp. Just really appalling.
Really horrifying.
Do you want to talk about that and the role of sort of anonymous reviews and how that...
Yeah. I think there's a moment when you have an interaction with somebody dining at your restaurant that you kind of know that they're a Yelper, and you just think either, well, I don't really like Yelp, so I my thought is, yuck, like, this stinks. But I also think that that person believes, to look at it more openly and less narrow-minded, that their voice matters, and everyone's voice does in turn matter. And so they really want to share something that they felt about your restaurant. And if they've really fully dined there, had the experience, and tried to understand you, and they have something to say, then, you know, of course I encourage them to go and do so. But I also think that there needs to be more encouragement around people reaching directly to the restaurant. Why is it necessary that if something didn't come out on time, do you need to tell the next person to dine there? It's probably just a glitch that evening. I don't think it's going to happen every night. But in this particular instant that you're speaking of, there was somebody who came to the door at Take Root, essentially, was very rude to me, and then went on Yelp and wrote a very homophobic and inappropriate message about who I was and what I looked like. Had nothing to do with my restaurant, nothing to do with my food, you know, our price point or how we served or our service or even the building, literally. It just was about the fact she was uncomfortable with who I was and what I looked like. And we felt like, the problem with these things like Yelp is that this is an access point, you know? This is a clear-cut avenue directly to also hate and also to really uncomfortable conversation that shouldn't happen anywhere public, if at all. And she had, all she had was a password and a username to be able to do that. So I think that there needs to be, you know, more filtering and more understanding of what these things are for. And again, that comes from outward conversation and visibility.
So a conversation in so many of these cases is key. And you know, one of the great hopes about food and one of the reasons it's, you know, has potential to solve all the problems of the world is if you eat together, share a real conversation rather than judging you because you don't look like, you know,
who she wanted you to look like.
You didn't have long blonde hair.
Yeah.
You can make a lot of progress in this world.
It's true.
And just not even crossing the door to sit and share what the meal is and understand even the piece of you that you're sharing that way. It's
no, it's totally true. Yeah. It really is. And the more people out there that are fighting the good fight, you know, I'm dear friend of mine, Julia Tertian, is literally on the front line trying just to get people to literally pass a piece of bread across the table and, you know, share your name, who you are, where you're from. And it's powerful, and it's so inspiring to see that people are actually responding. So
she is a warrior.
I know.
She is extraordinary.
I totally agree with you.
So the last question of the show is there a woman or who you admire who's in the food world? We always like to pass it forward and share someone who someone should look up, the same way, you know, you're reading Provence 1970, you're like, you look up all the people in the book that people should know about.
You know, just trying to think off the top of my head right now. I don't have a name that's coming to my mind right away, but what I've been starting to do actually is starting a suggestion of how to find somebody inspiring versus the person is to look very locally, like immediately locally. So if you're in a city on your block, maybe go ask the guy who owns your bodega where he's from. Why did he move here? I remember going to a farm stand in Saugerties, and I met this gentleman who owned it, and he's Sicilian, and we learned that our families had, you know, the same history and how they got to. And I said, why are you in Saugerties? Like, what are you doing here? And he told me, and he shared all these stories that I would have never known if I had not asked him. And so I think that these moments, those people become actually sources of inspiration to me right now, more so than somebody who is notable, because people know their story, and I already know their story. And I'm more inspired by learning someone's story they don't know.
That is a beautiful way to conclude this episode of Speaking Broadly. So how can people find you on social if they want to follow you?
My full name, so Elise Cornack, is my Instagram. It's also my website. So I was lucky. No one already had it.
Your website's really beautiful. Check out her website. Check her out on Instagram. And you know where to find me, FW Scout, on Instagram and Twitter. And thanks so much for listening. And we'll hope to have you back next week. And thank you to my engineer today, Matt, for doing a great job. And Carlin for forever being a great listener.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.